Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome once again to New Books in the American West, part of the New Books Network. I'm Stephen Hausman, your host for today's interview. I'm pleased to welcome Christina Snyder to the podcast. Dr. Snyder is the McCabe Greer Professor of History at Penn State University and is the author of Great Crossings, Indians, Settlers, and Slaves in the Age of Jackson, which came out in 2017 with Oxford University Press, and this year won the Francis Parkman Prize from the Society of American Historians. Christina, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
So why don't we begin by hearing about yourself? What got you interested in history, and what's your background as a historian?
Sure. I am originally from Macon, Georgia, and I grew up in a town called, well, it was originally called Okmulgee, and it was part of the old Creek Nation. And one of the things that really captivated me when I was younger was a mound site that we had in town there, which is one of the largest mound sites in North America. And so, you know, I was really interested in archaeology and material culture, and that's kind of what I studied in college. That's how I got into Native American history. But I was also kind of interested in thinking about how those Native-centered stories are part of the broader scope of American history, you know, how stories like that of Okmulgee might connect to other things that I knew about the region, for example, about colonialism and slavery. So just kind of broadly as a scholar, I'm still inspired by that quest to tell kind of a fuller scope of American history, including the history of Native peoples.
And how did you become interested in the topic of the Choctaw Academy, of Great Crossings, and of Jacksonian America?
Yeah, I in my first book, I wrote about slavery in Indian country. And when I was doing that research, I came across a letter that was written by Peter Pitchlin, who is one of the figures in this book. And it took place at Choctaw Academy. So he was a student at this boarding school, and he was describing in that letter his relationships with enslaved people, his kind of fraught relationships, some arguments that he'd gotten into. And, you know, I thought it was a really intriguing letter, and I couldn't do much with it in that first book. But later on, when I kind of got more into the topic, I discovered that this place that Pitchlin was writing from, Choctaw Academy, was the first federally controlled Indian school. So in the sense that it was controlled by the federal government and not a missionary society, and that a lot of famous Native Americans had gone to school there. And so that's really how I got on the track of looking at it, thinking about it from both a Native American history angle and history of slavery angle.
I feel like that's how a lot of really good historical works start, is you come across something in the archive and you just can't let it go, and you want to get back around to it.
Yeah, exactly. It was just one of those really intriguing documents. And that's been one of the, well, that was one of the really great things about researching this book, is that especially for a 19th century story, an early 19th century story, there are really a lot of documents authored by Native Americans, because so many people went to the school and became literate. and, you know, to a lesser extent, African-American documents as well. But it does have a really rich documentary record. So that's been a real joy in this project.
Well, let's jump into the book then. And it is, in many ways, it's a pretty dramatic story, and there's a lot of characters within it. So let's begin maybe by just talking about a few of the recurring people in the book and their backgrounds. And first, and you mentioned him already, but can you tell us who was Peter Pitchlin, and what world did he come from, and why he's important to the story?
Sure. So Peter Pitchlin was a Choctaw leader and in the 19th century. I'd say probably one of the most important Choctaw political figures of the 19th century. And he was born, his Choctaw name is Snapping Turtle. So he was born in what's now Mississippi. And he grew up in an elite family. So his mother came from a long line of chiefs. And of course, Choctaws practiced matrilineal kinship. So they got their family identities from their mother's side, and that lineage of chiefs gave him already a kind of prominent place in his nation. And his father was white. His father's name was John Pitchlin, and he had been raised among Choctaws, and as an adult had gained a certain amount of wealth by becoming a translator and planter. So, you know, he was very privileged as a youth, and he was very ambitious, too. He was the nephew of a Choctaw chief named Meshulatebi, who was one of the most prominent chiefs in the nation. And as his maternal nephew, Pitchlin was kind of Meshulatebi's heir apparent. And initially, Pitchlin had an education. He went to some white schools in Mississippi and Tennessee. And in terms of Western schooling, there were not a lot of options available for Native children at that time. So Pitchlin went to these schools, wasn't terribly satisfied, and he was interested in gaining access to more elite Western schooling so that he could take on a kind of new role in his nation. Because increasingly what his nation needed, like a lot of Native American nations at that time, was not the kind of masculine education of the 18th century, which had been in warcraft, but rather in diplomacy, in treaty making, in the law. The kind of leadership that he wanted for his people was something that would require really advanced education. So that's what led he and ultimately his nation to seek out this higher schooling. And Pitchlin himself was a student at Choctaw Academy. And he went on to also study law, had a prominent career as a politician, and eventually became chief of the Choctaw Nation. He's interesting in this story in that, you know, he's present at almost the very beginning of the school, and then he also plays a leading role in closing the school down in the mid-19th century.
And who was Richard Mentor Johnson? What was his background, and what was his life like at Great Crossings, Kentucky?
So Richard Mentor Johnson was a really prominent Democratic politician. He's from Kentucky. He was Kentucky's first congressman that had actually been born in the territory instead of in Virginia or another American state. And he too came from a prominent family. His father was one of the largest landholders in Kentucky. He grew up on a plantation. He became really famous during the War of 1812 because he supposedly killed Tecumseh, the great Indian leader, at the Battle of the Thames. And that was disputed at the time. It's, you know, historians still argue about it. But the kind of point of that is that most Americans at the time believed that Johnson had killed Tecumseh. And in a war that in many ways was not terribly memorable, Johnson was one of the heroes. And so he really kind of rode that prominence to political fame. He eventually became vice president under Martin Van Buren. And he was a really controversial figure in the Democratic Party and in American politics kind of more broadly.
Right, which brings us to the third person I wanted to ask about. And while Pitchlin and Johnson both came from rather elite circles in their communities and their societies, Julia Chin did not. Can you tell us who she was and why she matters to the story?
Yes. So Julia Chin grew up in the Johnson household. She was an enslaved woman. Her mother had also been a slave in the Johnson household. She and her siblings all took the surname Chin, which is kind of an unusual surname, but there are some Kentucky families with that name. And this kind of indicates her father was probably white, and that possibly, you know, the family wanted to retain that association with him. So as an enslaved woman, she served within the Johnson household's oral history indicates that she was a maid to Johnson's mother, Jemima, and that Jemima taught her how to read and write. And we do know that she was literate because later in life she wrote letters to Johnson. So, you know, that evidence suggests that she probably did learn how to read and write as a child. But when she is about 20 years old and Johnson is about 30 years old, we know by this time that they had a sexual relationship. And, you know, unfortunately, like so many relationships between enslaved people and masters in the 19th century, you know, there's it's probably coercive in some way. You know, we don't really have a way of knowing how it started or, you know, what Julia thought about it. But they did have two children together, and they did have a long-term relationship. So Johnson himself never married a white woman. And for all intents and purposes, people at Great Crossings often called Julia Chin his, quote, wife. They certainly did raise their children together, and Richard Johnson did emancipate the two children that they had together, Julia and Imogene. And Chin's an interesting figure because, you know, she's enslaved. Her life and her opportunities are circumscribed in all kinds of ways in antebellum Kentucky. At the same time, she is the mistress of this very powerful man, and Johnson himself, because he's a politician, he is gone to Washington, D.C. for 6 months out of the year, you know, really every year of their adult lives together. And during that time, he puts Chin in charge of the plantation and also in charge of running the day-to-day affairs at the school, Choctaw Academy. So she and other enslaved people are very much involved in the life of the school and the community.
So these are just three of the many, many characters that crop up again and again in this book. But let's zoom out a little bit and tell us, if you will, about the founding of Choctaw Academy. Why was it, as you describe in the book, as an ambitious experiment in education? And then why did both Johnson as well as many Native American leaders argue for the need for such a school?
Yeah, so it was really a different kind of educational experiment. And at the time, the federal government really thought of the school as part of its broader civilization policy. And this is a broader Indian policy that sought to remake Native people in the image of white Americans. And education was part of that. Although most of what the federal government did was to support mission societies. And the interesting thing about Native nations at this time and their attitudes toward education was that, you know, oftentimes, you know, many Native nations, especially those in the East who had a lot of contact with the United States, they did want to have Western schooling. You know, they did want English literacy. They wanted to be able to read treaties and negotiate trade deals and so forth, you know. but they didn't necessarily want conversion. You know, Christian conversion was actually much more controversial in Indian communities in the early 19th century. And so essentially Choctaw Academy is seen as kind of a secular alternative that still, you know, from the perspective of the U.S., fulfills that larger civilization policy. And from the perspective of Native Americans, gives them access to Western schooling without Christian conversion. So I'll leave it there as kind of that's the beginning of the school, which has, you know, kind of an auspicious start. And part of the interesting thing about it is that it really receives very little money from the federal government. Almost all the money comes from Native American nations.
What were life and education like at the Choctaw Academy for students and for teachers as well as for enslaved people, particularly in the early years? The book is full of a lot of really fantastic stories ranging from, you know, frankly, pretty funny ones to ones that are also downright tragic and horrifying. So can you give us kind of a broad overview of what life was like there?
Sure. It's you know, because of the rich documentary nature of this this place, you can really tell these incredibly human stories. So like you said, you know, sometimes they're funny, sometimes they're tragic. Often they involve a lot of pain, you know. So that's been one of the great things about bringing this project to life. But just to give you maybe a little bit of a taste of what life was like there, one of the interesting things is that this was an incredibly diverse place in early America. So Choctaw Academy was the largest and most culturally diverse Indian school in the antebellum period. So, you know, over the course of its history, from the 1820s to the 1840s, there were almost 700 Indian boys and men representing 17 different tribal nations. And these nations are really, really diverse. So they don't necessarily all speak the same language. You've got people who speak Muskogean languages from the Deep South, like the Choctaws and Chickasaws. You also have fur trading peoples from the Great Lakes region, like the Potawatomis, the Miamis. And a lot of them, you know, already spoke some English, but if they spoke a European language, it was more likely to be French. And we know that at least one member of the student body had actually traveled to France before and had lived there for several years. You even have some students who come from plains peoples, like the Osages, for example, who are bison hunters. And so even the students at this school would have found one another to be incredibly culturally diverse and foreign. You know, it was really the first time that they were meeting Native boys and men from such different kinds of places. And, you know, there are some conflicts with students, but overall they seem to have valued that experience as, you know, a kind of brotherhood bonding experience. We know, for example, that they taught one another dances and played tribal sports together, like stickball, for example. And they also thought of this experience as a kind of study abroad, immersive experience. So, you know, I mentioned before that this was a secular school, that, you know, religion wasn't part of the curriculum, but students could and did go to church on Sundays if they chose to. And, you know, some of these students were, for example, Great Lakes people were often already Catholic, so they went to a Catholic church that was nearby. Some of the Southeastern peoples were Baptist, and the Baptist church was the closest church. And especially in doing things like going to church or, you know, meeting other members of the community that way, they were invited into white households. We know that they had dinner at people's houses. And local whites in Kentucky thought that this was a really fascinating place as well. So one of the things that Choctaw Academy did, which was very common, you know, all American academies did this at the time, was to have annual exhibitions. And basically this is kind of a public demonstration of what the students have been learning all year. And they would do different exercises like spelling or elocution or have a debate or something like that. And at Choctaw Academy, these were open to the public. And in fact, Johnson kind of used this as a campaigning event, and he would have free food and things like that. And so thousands of people would come to this, you know, small community from all over the state. And even, you know, if politicians were passing through the area, they would come and visit. So at the time, you know, this was really a famous kind of place and, you know, a place that was looked at with interest both from Washington, D.C. and from Indian country.
And one of the events that stuck out for me in the book was the so-called coffee riot. And I'm wondering if you could briefly describe what that particular incident was and what it tells us about the complicated racial hierarchy that existed at the Choctaw Academy.
Sure. So one of the incidents where enslaved people and students came into close contact was in the dining hall because slaves served as cooks and also the wait staff at the dining hall. And I got, you know, quite a few documents that mentioned different kinds of, you know, either friendships that sparked there or, you know, more often conflicts in the dining hall. And basically what happened with this coffee riot incident was, you know, the Native students, they complained a lot about the food that was offered at Choctaw Academy, partly because it wasn't what they were used to, but partly because students felt like it was cheap food, you know, that they were not getting nice food. And you know, people then and now, we read a lot of meaning into food, right? Like what is, what reflects our kind of status in society, right? And one of the things that the students complained about a lot was coffee, that they were actually, many of the tribes were used to having coffee at home. It was a very common commodity in Indian country. And when they came to school, they complained that Johnson mixed the coffee with rye, and that essentially it was weak, cheap coffee. And the incident at this coffee riot was students were having breakfast one morning. They started to complain to the wait staff about this coffee. And we don't know how exactly, but these verbal attacks on the wait staff became physical, and the students started throwing coffee at the wait staff and eventually throwing stones at them too. This incident, I think, gets at the really complex nature of race and status in that community. Because on the one hand, you have these students, many of whom come from elite backgrounds. And this incident happened in the 1820s when removal is certainly being discussed. Students are in a foreign land. They're kind of fighting for what they see as their right to be respected, to be treated as equals with white Americans. And many of the students also came from slaveholding families, those in the South. And so they themselves brought racist attitudes to school. On the side of the African Americans, what was happening was that the influx of hundreds of Indian students, you know, boys and young men, had created an incredible workload for them. And what they complained about were assaults on their dignity or, you know, unreasonable demands from students. And so you have these kind of, there's a convergence of peoples and cultures in this space in Great Crossings, but also a convergence of expectations, you know, that were sometimes at odds with one another.
So in 1828, Andrew Jackson is elected to the presidency, and there's a subsequent changes in Indian policy throughout the United States. Can you tell us how his election and these changes in policy, how they affected both life at Choctaw Academy as well as throughout Native North America in general?
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's a big question, but I'll tackle it. So the election of Jackson is really a turning point in this story that I'm telling, but also in Native American history more broadly. You know, we tend to think of the presidency of Andrew Jackson as being about Cherokee removal. You know, oftentimes Cherokee removal is kind of at the center of our popular thoughts about the history of the era. But when he comes into office, he's riding a wave of popular support from Democrats, many of whom are kind of newly empowered white poor farmers, people who are ambitious, people who are looking to Indian country to settle. And ultimately, you know, he is championing what's popular among that constituency, which is the removal of indigenous people and the transfer of that land into the public domain and, you know, for the distribution to white settlers. So ultimately, what happens with Indian removal is that it becomes a blanket policy that targets not just the Cherokee Nation, but all Indians living east of the Mississippi. So ultimately, that policy forcibly removed about 100,000 Native Americans westward to Indian territory, mostly what's now Oklahoma and Kansas. The policy is really important for a lot of reasons. I mean, first of all, it's you know, kind of like incalculable human tragedy. You know, in some tribes, up to 40% of people died because of the kind of abuses and mismanagement that took place during the Trail of Tears. And you know, I can talk more about Indian territory later. But it is, you know, like first we have to think about the human tragedy of all this. And part of it, too, is that it is a kind of policy of ethnic cleansing that really seeks to remake the United States east of the Mississippi. You know, I talked before about like the status of Indians and how it created certain kinds of ambiguity in the racial hierarchy. And what Indian removal sought to do was to get rid of that ambiguity and to make the U.S. really a place of white citizens. And the only other people who were tolerated were enslaved people. At Choctaw Academy, the like part of what's happening here when we think about Indian removal is that it's a huge policy change because previously, the U.S. operated under the civilization policy. And even though the ultimate goal was similar in that the United States was trying to get Indian land, it's really a policy of assimilation. And removal is just that, right? It seeks to expel Indians from the U.S. It's an expulsion and segregation policy. And so people start to say, well, what's the point of educating Indians? You know, what's the point of having a place like Choctaw Academy? And so as Jackson's presidency wears on, Choctaw Academy itself really becomes a battleground, and it becomes this political lightning rod in a way. And you can kind of see that from multiple angles. And from the perspective of Indian people, they still wanted education for the same reasons that they had always wanted, because they felt like it would be an important weapon to help them fight American imperialism or deal with the U.S. economy. From the perspective of white Americans, they themselves were actually quite divided about Indian removal. It was a very divisive issue in its day. So not necessarily everyone supported Jackson's policy. And in fact, a lot of people worked against it. So you kind of see these different factions debate the role of race and education as the 1830s and 1840s wear on.
You mentioned the changing curriculum at Choctaw Academy, and I want to circle back around to that in a second. But first, briefly, since you did mention Indian territory and life in Indian territory, in the book, it is described as a land of death. Can you tell us briefly what life was like there and why it was so deadly to so many people?
Sure. The Choctaws in particular called Indian Territory the Land of Death. And part of that was because in their origin story, they remember anciently migrating from a Western land that had been full of death and suffering. And they had purposely come east to their homeland in what's now Mississippi to escape that. And so, when they thought back to their oral traditions, they thought about, they kind of identified Indian Tory as the land of death, you know. So in their minds, those two became linked. And unfortunately, in reality, it bore out a lot of that name. And part of it is, part of the reason for the suffering in Indian Territory, we could go back partly to the government's policy of removal and its practices. One of the things that made removal so deadly was that the federal government contracted out transportation and feeding of the immigrants to private individuals. They contracted these things out to the lowest bidder, and there was really very little oversight in the system. So, you know, some of these contractors never provisioned the Indian immigrants at all. Others bought spoiled food or didn't buy shoes or, there are all kinds of things that could have been avoided, but certainly the conditions of removal themselves really amplified the suffering of people. So if people didn't necessarily die of starvation, they may have died of disease or exposure. And then part of the reason for this name, the Land of Death, is also ecological. And Oklahoma itself is we know today it has a lot of extremes of weather. You know, it's got droughts, it's got tornadoes, and you know, while those things are certainly present in parts of the East, Oklahoma does have more extreme weather. And it just so happens that during this time of the Trail of Tears, Oklahoma and the surrounding region was undergoing a drought that was actually worse than the Dust Bowl of the 1920s. So we know this from climate data now. And at that time, there were prairie fires, tornadoes, huge floods that came in the summers and took out crops, or after the floods, mosquitoes might breed in there and spread disease. If we think about the toll of removal, we have to think about not just the Trail of Tears itself, but the immediate aftermath. The lack of provisions, the kind of natural disasters for which there was really no support or relief. So these are the kinds of conditions that Native people faced in the immediate aftermath of the Trail of Tears. So, I mean, they're trying to remake their lives in a very difficult place. Ultimately, they do manage to reestablish their nations, reestablish governments, homes, feed themselves, but they do it amid incredible adversity.
As you alluded to a little while ago, the so-called Age of Jackson and the Age of Removal, it creates changes at Choctaw Academy, particularly changes in the curriculum there. So what changes, and how do both students and Native leaders respond to these changes?
So one of the solutions that administrators at Choctaw Academy come up with to address policy change during Jackson's administration is to kind of de-emphasize the elite classical education that the school had initially offered. So, part of the school's appeal in its early days was that it gave students the option to do things like study moral philosophy, classical history, even Greek and Latin. And in fact, a small number of students did go on to do things like go to law school and medical school. It was a very competitive classical kind of education. But in the later years, what happens is that administrators introduce manual labor into the curriculum. And this is kind of a way of justifying the school's existence to the Jackson administration by saying, we are, you know, preparing Native children for work as laborers, you know, and not as these elite, classically educated men. There are all kinds of ways in which the school tries to enforce this curriculum. Partially, some students were assigned to like labor on the plantation, like fix a roof or work in the fields alongside enslaved people. Students were also kind of sometimes offered small amounts of money to take classes to learn how to become a tailor or a wheelwright, you know, more artisanal trades. And these are incredibly unpopular changes to the curriculum in Indian country because basically, you know, it really undermines the whole reason that Native leaders had sent their children to the school in the first place. You know, they say, well, actually, the school is incredibly expensive, and we could teach them how to be blacksmiths at home, you know. They felt like students were being trained for subservient roles as part of the American underclass, or perhaps even on the same level as enslaved people. This is really the point at which Native nations who are footing the bill, after all, they're paying the tuition for these students. They decide they need to come up with an alternate plan, some different kind of schooling that's out of the control of the federal government.
At the end of the 1830s, Richard Johnson, his national ambitions are realized to an extent, and he emerges as Martin Van Buren's vice presidential candidate. Can you tell us a bit about what the national reaction was to Johnson's candidacy, and then how that reaction affected Johnson's family and life at Great Crossings in general?
Sure. So, yeah, really the apex of Jackson's political career is his vice presidency under Van Buren. And it's interesting because one of the things that I was intrigued by was how people in Kentucky thought about the Johnson family and especially Johnson's relationship with Julia Chen and his two daughters. And part of what's interesting about Johnson is that in contrast to some other early American leaders like Thomas Jefferson, for example, who were kind of very closed about relationships with enslaved people, Johnson was very open. And so, you know, local people knew that he had these two biracial daughters. He had parties at his house and so forth. So, you know, in a way, he was very open about it. And what's partially interesting about his political career is that his family life didn't really become a huge issue or liability until he became a candidate at the national stage. So what happens when he becomes the Democratic candidate for vice president is that there's a huge backlash against that. And in fact, the Virginia delegation in particular refuses to cast their ballots for Johnson. And they specifically bring up his biracial daughters and his relationship with Julia Chen as the leading reason why they're doing this. And this really continues to plague him for the rest of his political career. So it has a tremendous impact. Part of this is that the story comes at a time when the second party system is really intensifying, and you have these two very distinct parties, Democrats and the Whigs. And so Johnson's family life becomes fodder for his political enemies. He does go on to become vice president, although he doesn't actually have the votes to do it. So he's still the only vice president who was confirmed by a vote in the Senate. So that gives you a sense of, you know, how ambivalent white American voters were about his candidacy. And it does have a big impact, too, on his family. By this point, actually, Julia Chen had died. She had died in a cholera epidemic because she is actually a kind of nurse practitioner who treated the sick in the area. But it has a tremendous impact on his surviving daughters and their families. And I think, you know, one way in which this can be read is the really part of the effects of scientific racism and an increasingly kind of virulent sectional politics that are partially about race. So Johnson himself and his family really are at the center of that.
You introduce toward the end of the book another important character, Dr. Adam Nail. Can you tell me who he was and why his, as you describe it, his rebellion sparks a sea change and kind of begins the ball rolling toward the downfall of the Choctaw Academy?
Sure. So one of the interesting figures in the book, Adam Nail, he is a Choctaw who is one of the brightest, most high-achieving students in the school's history. He initially starts off as a regular student, and then he starts to study medicine. And at that time, the study of medicine wasn't necessarily formalized in the way it is now. And so what he did mostly was an apprenticeship with a local physician. He goes through this apprenticeship. He may have also taken courses at a nearby university. And eventually he becomes Dr. Adam Nail. So he's a practicing physician, and he takes over the duties of doctor at Choctaw Academy. And he's one of a small group of Native men who do become teachers or administrators at the school. I don't know exactly how this happens. I mean, one of the ways that I could imagine it might have happened is that through his practice, Dr. Nail, he sees student injuries, he's talking to students, he's maybe hearing about abuses, and eventually what he begins to do is to undermine Johnson's control of the school. He lashes out against Johnson, against the curriculum. He eventually writes a petition that outlines the various charges against the school, and many of the students sign the petition. And that petition is sent to the U.S. federal government and also to the Choctaw Nation, the officials of the Choctaw Nation. And it has a tremendous impact. So there's actually a congressional investigation into the school. And that's really the beginning of the end of the school in terms of its support in Indian country, because Choctaw leaders take these charges very seriously, and they decide themselves to think about how to withdraw students and come up with educational alternatives.
Which brings us back to Peter Pitchlin, because toward the end of the tenure of Choctaw Academy, he steps in as superintendent, and there's really a power struggle between him and Johnson. So what had Pitchlin accomplished in the interim between his time at the school and when he returned? And then how does he finally bring about the academy's closure?
Yeah, so Pitchlin had left Choctaw Academy in the 1820s, and he thereafter went to the University of Nashville, which is now Vanderbilt University, and had really become an important statesman. And his role in Indian Territory after removal was to think about how to rebuild the Choctaw Nation. And partially as a result of Adam Nail's petition, what the Choctaw Tribal Council does is to make Peter Pitchlin their new superintendent of schools. And his idea is that the Choctaw Nation should withdraw the money that it's spending on Choctaw Academy and build its own system of public schools in Indian Territory. He thinks that will be money better spent, that it can actually be managed by appropriate tribal officials. Students will be closer to home. You know, there are a lot of different benefits, and it's it becomes a reality because basically what Pitchland does is he goes to Washington, D.C. and acts as a kind of lobbyist. So he curries favors with the new administration, among whom are many critics of Richard Johnson for, you know, maybe not necessarily for the Choctaw Academy issue, but for other kinds of issues in Johnson's career. And he gets the approval of the War Department, which then controlled Indian Affairs, to become the new superintendent of Choctaw Academy itself. And what's interesting is that Pitchland's entire plan is to close down the school. You know, he's really not interested in reforming it. What he wants to do is to, first of all, get into Richard Johnson's record books to catalog mismanagement, you know, to prove to the federal government that that Native nations need educational alternatives, and secondly, to withdraw particularly the students from his nation, the Choctaw Nation, because that's really all he has the authority to do, but also to help other students who may be interested in returning to their own tribal nations to get back home. And so that's exactly what he does in 1842 and 1843. So that's really the beginning of the end of the school, because his activism is very inspirational to other tribal nations. And he actually becomes an attorney for some other tribes to wrangle with the federal government to regain control of their tribal money. And what most of the Native nations do is to withdraw that money and build their own public school systems in Indian Territory. So there's actually kind of an untold history of a thriving system of tribally controlled schools that existed in Oklahoma or Indian Territory really until about 1900.
And just to put a period at the end of the story of the Choctaw Academy, when do the last students leave the school?
The last students leave in 1848.
So it lasts a little bit longer after the beginning of the 1840s, but it peters out over the course of the decade.
It does, yeah. So once Pitchland and Adam Nail kind of start that process in the early 1840s, it does take a while. And part of it is because, you know, the tribal nations themselves aren't unified. You know, Pitchland and Adam Nail, they speak for the Choctaws, but at that time there are still, you know, over a dozen different Indian nations there, and not everybody's on the same page. So some people think Choctaw Academy is problematic, but they don't really have educational alternatives. Some people want to wait until they actually get schools built to bring students home, and some nations actually do something interesting, which is to take the students who had gone to Choctaw Academy and place them in American colleges and universities. So some of them haven't totally given up on American educational institutions. They just decide to place their students elsewhere.
And finally, you end the book in the conclusion by describing the legacy of many of the important people from the story that you tell, as well as the ideals that they carry on. So can you briefly tell us what happened to people like Richard Mentor Johnson and like Peter Pitchland and their families throughout the Civil War and the post-war eras?
Sure. So I try to trace some of the people from the book in their postgraduate lives or, you know, after the school closes. And, you know, it's interesting because in many ways this is such a forgotten place and it's seen as a failed experiment. But at the same time, it had a really profound impact on the people who were involved, as well as policies in the U.S. and in Indian Country. So the school itself is going to shape how the United States creates later Indian boarding schools like Carlisle, for example. And it also shapes, you know, how Choctaws and other people think about their public schooling system and what, you know, indigenous controlled schools should look like. So it definitely shapes policy. In terms of people's individual lives, you know, many of the Indian students, even those with critiques of Choctaw Academy, take those experiences and those critiques and try to transform them into improving lives for themselves or their families or their nations. And so, for example, you know, we have people like Adam Nail, so the kind of whistleblower at Choctaw Academy. He is expelled, or, you know, also fired from his role as Academy doctor. He goes to Indian Territory and becomes a doctor there. So he has a practice, and actually some of his children and grandchildren also become doctors. So it becomes kind of family profession. Other people become, they start newspapers. They become tribal leaders. They become judges. They become chiefs. So what happens with a lot of these men is that they start to form the backbone of post-removal Indian nations. So part of what they want to do is to think about how to help their nations survive the trauma of removal and reinvent themselves into modern nation states that have kinds of social services, you know, like medicine, for example, and education and so forth. When we look at other groups that were involved at Choctaw Academy, I mean, one of the interesting stories is that of enslaved people who were there. So, for example, Imogene, Johnson's daughter, she certainly suffers from the kind of politicization of her family during Johnson's vice presidency. But ultimately, she remains in Kentucky. She marries a white man, one of her neighbors. They raise their children and grandchildren right there in the community. And even though there are conflicts there, they're kind of drawing on that extensive web of kinship to support a life that's empowering for them and their families. And part of what we know is that Imogene uses the education that she got covertly at Choctaw Academy. So I haven't mentioned this part, but part of the reason that Johnson wanted the school there was to help educate his daughters. So we have things that remain like her account books that show, you know, how she dispersed property and how she thought about investing, for example. Other enslaved people, they drew on their, again, like more covert educational experiences to become literate. And many of the people from that community after emancipation, they become exodusters on the high plains of Kansas. So they're some of the founders of a famous all-black town in Kansas called Nicodemus. And part of what makes that community so strong and part of what community leaders want to do there when they first show up is to found schools. So that kind of desire for education, legacy of education, continues to play a role in African American communities that are descended from Great Crossings as well.
Well, it's a powerful and really rich book, and there are so many things that I wanted to ask you about, but that we didn't really have time for, including, I mean, Charles Dickens makes an appearance in the book, and we didn't get a chance to talk about him and Peter Pitchlin's meeting, for one thing.
Yeah.
But if there's one takeaway that you hope that readers come away from your book with, what would it be?
Well, part of, I think, what surprises people about this story is really the possibility of that moment you know, we're so used to thinking about the early republic as a time of closing off of opportunities for people of color. And I think it's a real cautionary tale against seeing any kind of a linear view of American history, whether that's, you know, a kind of story of American exceptionalism, where America's always getting better all the time, or a story of simple declension, you know, when it comes to Native people, for example. You know, instead, I think that there are kind of these cyclical patterns. If we take the moment of Choctaw Academy, for example, it shows us really the possibilities of Americans working to create a future that is more inclusive, that is more tolerant, and, you know, the ways in which that can break apart, you know. So I think it's a real lesson for our own time.
So, as you well know, historians rarely rest, and we like to, on this podcast, get a preview of what our authors that we talk to are working on next. So do you have an idea of a next project? Any idea what you're going to be getting into kind of down the road?
Yeah, I'm actually kind of jumping into a new project that carries some of the themes of my previous work. It's called Slavery After the Civil War: The Slow Death and Many Afterlives of Bondage. And basically what I'm looking at here is how the United States thinks about applying abolition as a policy in the West and overseas as it expands in the postbellum period. You know, how to deal with things like the enslavement of African Americans in Indian Territory, or Latino peons in the Southwest, or Indian slaves in the Great Basin. You know, in some ways, it's an expansive project. It's carrying my work into a later time period, but it also picks up on some of these earlier themes of bridging Native American and African American historiographies, and thinking about U.S. history more continentally, and, you know, kind of the effects of American imperialism for different groups of people.
Well, I will anxiously await the release of that project.
Well, thank you.
Christina Snyder is the McCabe Greer Professor of History at Penn State University, and her new book is Great Crossings: Indians, Settlers, and Slaves in the Age of Jackson, which came out last year with Oxford University Press, and in 2018 won the Francis Parkman Prize from the Society of American Historians. Christina, thanks again for coming on the show.
Okay, thanks so much for having me.